today on Against the Grain, Peter Linebaugh, best known for tracing the history of the commons and of commoning practices, calls Thomas Paine a planetary revolutionary. I'm CS. Professor Linebaugh claims we have much to learn from both the life and writings of Tom Paine, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Thomas Paine was, according to my guest today, many things. A worker, commoner, outlaw, traitor, alien, felon, and populist. The historian Peter Linebaugh says Paine was also a planetary revolutionary, which might sound a bit strange to those familiar only or primarily with Paine's incendiary pamphlet Common Sense, which urged the 13 colonies to break away from Great Britain. But Peter Linebaugh has found in Tom Paine's lesser-known works radical critiques of inequality and authoritarianism, and even the system of money wages. In fact, writes Linebaugh, Paine's life and writings help us understand the tasks of revolution and constitution in this, the 21st century. Peter Linebaugh is a professor of history at the University of Toledo. His new book is Stop Thief, The Commons, Enclosures, and Resistance. Stop Thief is a collection of essays, one of which first appeared as the introduction to an edition published by Verso of Thomas Paine's The Rights of Man and Common Sense. Paine was born in the east of England in 1737. When Peter Linebaugh joined me recently in studio, he had this to say about the landscape of Paine's youth.
First, there's the agrarian field, and it's an enclosed field. The areas of common lands were still present. For example, in the waters, the town he grew up in was Thetford, and a river ran through it, and the fish belonged to the commoners of the town. His father was free of the town, that is, he was a commoner, and therefore had the right to put a cow on the town commons.
What do you mean, free of the town?
Yes, the English medieval word free meant he had the privileges of the town. And among those privileges was to pasture a cow on the commons. Also, another aspect, it wasn't, this part of Norfolk was not the bountiful part of agrarian experimentation in root crops that are well known to students of the history of the agricultural revolution. No, this part was more barren, and it was, but it was the source of a great warren for raising rabbits, rabbits for commercial sale. But this had become, the warren had become enclosed or privatized. There was struggle over it. And Tom Paine would have known this, would have grown up with it. And in a literal way, it was terrifying in that Tom Paine grew up in the shadow of the gallows at Gallows Hill, which was less than a mile from his home. His father was a Quaker. His mother was an Anglican. That is, she was established. He was a dissenter. The Quaker meeting house was next to the town jail. This is where Tom Paine grew up.
And when you say the lands, or some of the lands, were enclosed, do you mean literally there were fences built up around them, or that going on the lands to take the rabbits or to forage for fuel was prohibited, was criminalized, or both?
Both. So not all the area is privatized or enclosed, but most is. The place for foraging for fuel or for the rabbit warren are separate. And then there's a third very significant region of 5 miles away from Thetford, a place known as the Brecklands, and the place of Grimes Graves. This is significant because this was a source of military strategic importance going back thousands of years, inasmuch as it was the source of flints, that were used as points to arrows and spears. But then at the time that Paine was growing up, these flints struck steel on the musket, the famous Brown Bess of the American Revolution. And the American revolutionaries ran short of flints. As I said, it was a key strategic material. So Tom Paine's role in the American Revolution was many-sided, but I found it curious that the Americans needed these flints from his natal region. So Paine knew whereof he spoke, and as I'm on the subject of the American Revolution, I mean, everybody knows that he wrote Common Sense. But the other thing that he did, which I think is very significant, you know, the concept of the people's war. He wanted the householders, the housewives of Philadelphia, to collect the nitrogen that is in the leavings of animals in their barns and cellars, because these was an essential ingredient to gunpowder. So there was a popular mobilization for the production of arms materials. The arms was within the hands of the people, so to speak.
Yeah, as you write, Tom Paine was interested in sort of the material particularities of revolution, as well as sort of the big idea of revolution too, right? He was interested in actually how people would go about revolting using what kinds of substances even.
Yes, yes. He was quite aware of this, and I think it has to do with the fact that he had always been a worker, a working artisan. So he knows that the hand is the source of wealth. And just thinking of the hand, he wrote Common Sense in January 1776, and he proposed that something like a Declaration of Independence be written. And George Washington really thought that this pamphlet turned the tide and raised morale at a dismal stage in the war. But what Tom Paine did with the royalties was he donated them for the making of mittens and of gloves for the soldiers in the winter. So he was thoughtful in this, as you say, particularist way.
Now, the movement of flint across the Atlantic to North America, that brings to mind just sort of where commerce stood in Tom Paine's time in England and the degree to which capitalism and commodification had developed.
Yes, there's several ways of approaching this issue, but I think, first of all, Tom Paine, when he left England as a failure in both love and work at the age of 37, he left for Philadelphia. But he had tried, first of all, to become not a pirate, but a sailor on a privateer. And he was 6 months at sea. He was a sailoring man because the movement of commodities across the Atlantic requires labor and skilled labor and massive labor. Usually we think of it in terms of the middle passage of the African-American slaves, but it's those slaves and the other commodities were carried across the ocean by sailors. And Tom Paine was such a person. So he had that practical relationship to the transatlantic commodity. I think there are other ways, important ways, the transatlantic commodities of that era are going to transform the world. You know, the drug trade, basically, if you see refined sugar as a drug, as one should, but also tobacco, coffee. These were the ingredients. I mean, historians sometimes evasively call it the luxury trade. I prefer to think of it as the drug trade to establish continuity. And that trade involved massive exploitation and the creation of boat people of three continents, of Africa, Europe, and America. And Tom Paine was in the middle of it. That's why when he eventually did get to Philadelphia, really he already had a global or a planetary outlook. He wrote articles against the slave trade right away. He wrote articles against the exploitation of India and the attempted conquest of India and the cruelties of British soldiers or the British military machine in India. I mean, Americans, of course, remember him and think of him as an abolitionist. But I want to, you know, assert here right away that Tom Paine was a world figure and was conscious of his global reach and the global reach of the so-called civilization that he was a part of.
Peter Linebaugh teaches history at the University of Toledo. We are talking about his new book, Stop Thief, The Commons, Enclosures, and Resistance. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. You write that Tom Paine grew up around a tradition of rebellion, of local rebellion, in the area where he grew up and in England more generally. What can you tell us about sort of this legacy of rebellion and revolt locally that might have gotten into his blood as he grew up?
Yes. First of all, there's a school teacher born at his time and in that town who wrote precisely on this subject. Even though most of his writing, this guy's name was Bloomfield, most of his writing concern things that don't really interest us today, or on this subject anyway. But he did refer to the great peasants' revolt of 1381 in Norfolk and in Thetford. He did refer to the massive rebellion known as Kett's Rebellion, the great camping time of 1549 against the enclosures conducted by the Tudors. And most significantly, he wrote about Norfolk during the English Revolution. And here's something I discovered, that Tom Paine's ancestor on his mother's side was an active Cromwellian during that revolution. And I read his legal treatise, and while he was not a leveller, he wrote extensively about levellers. Levellers are the people who called for universal franchise. Levelers are the people who called for the leveling of estates and of enclosures. This was the radical party of the English Revolution. This was an ancestor to Thomas Paine.
So Tom Paine, for a time, made corsets, his sort of artisan phase. He apprenticed to his father, who was a corset maker, and I was at it for about 7 years. Then he went sailing for 6 months. And then he became, and this is a little bit ironic, he became an officer in the excise. So he was sort of an excise tax officer. What do you think he learned there about commerce, and in this case, perhaps especially about the burden that taxes place on people of very little means?
What he learned, as he said, was the spirit of fraud. He wrote it was his first publication, had to do with called The Case of the Excise Officers. The income of the excise officer did not include any material particularities, and he was working in a bureaucratic machine. It was a step up for him, as the government and the excise department particularly was expanding in this fiscal state, as the historians call it, a state that on the one hand makes war and on the other hand raises taxes to pay for such wars. This was the character of the state, and he had a low position in it. It required him to dun people, and I think judging from his case of the excise officer, the thing that he published, he began to develop an aversion to wage labor, where he has to do the bidding of his bosses, and he has to bring money to his bosses, and he has to collect this money from traders along the coast. So he has to pay for his horse. He has to pay for the feed for the horse, you know, getting to particularities. And he did not receive an income commensurate with these expenses. He was not quite a small businessman in this. Like, it's the beginning of a bureaucratic position, and he detested it. He wasn't good at it. He couldn't bend. He didn't know. But also at this time of life, though, it gave him some time to travel about.
But couldn't we say that with regard to the wage, what he wanted was to hike the pay? He wanted to increase the pay, and that was part of what he was arguing in this pamphlet, The Case of the Officers of Excise. So was it that he wanted more pay, or was it also that he was somehow attacking the wage relation?
Yeah, I think it's both. The wage relation is becoming new in its modern form. That is, it's becoming a variable. And it's becoming also the other side of the wage relationship is the prices of necessities. And these also, as the market economy develops, these prices also become variable. And so they are the source of the subsistence crises that could threaten starvation or dearth. So I think, C.S., that's a wonderful insight that he's complaining both about the form of it, but he also wants an increase to it.
He also argues that poverty, hunger, and privation, they do something to the conscience, right? The conscience of the poor person, the person who is, at that point, perhaps, just struggling to survive.
Yes, he writes that poverty, like grief, has an incurable deafness which never hears. The oration loses all its edge, and to be or not to be becomes the only question. Later, and he will argue that poverty debases the mind. He begins to understand, this is after some experience, this is by the 1790s, he begins to see that poverty is a deliberate policy of the state, which would rather break the spirit of the people by poverty, even at the risk of desperation among the poor, where desperation could lead to desperate deeds.
So poverty is not a natural phenomenon. It's man-made here. It's human-made.
Yes, this was Thomas Paine's deepest insight. He wasn't alone in this insight by any means, but to him, uncivilization meant the creation of riches was simultaneously and necessarily the creation of poverty.
You know, inequality is sort of a watchword for today's left. How concerned was Tom Paine with growing disparities at that time between rich and poor?
Deeply. I think this was his probably most difficult, well, I won't say it was the most difficult, but a difficult problem that he faced it in France. He faced it in the USA. He faced it in England. And he faced it also in Ireland, even though he himself didn't go to Ireland. Rights of Man, Parts 1 and Part 2, had a greater success in Ireland than anywhere else. And Part 2 most powerfully attempts to solve this inequality between wealth and wretchedness.
And what does he propose in Part 2? What solution does he offer to inequality?
He wants everyone at 21, at the age of 21, to have an acre of land and a cow, a basis of subsistence. He wants everyone at age 50 to have a pension. He wants everyone at the beginning of their working life and at its conclusion to have within their own hands the means of subsistence and life. And of course, this is the opposite to the trend of industrialization, of industrial capitalism, of the factory, the prison, and so on.
So he demanded that the state provide this property, these resources to everyone at both of those ages?
Yes. And in the 1940s, C.S., this was recognized in America, and it was heralded. I mean, it was propounded. Thomas Paine wasn't just the leader of a political independence. He was also a people's man, and he was called Tom Paine. I should say, in 1949, J. Edgar Hoover wanted all his books removed from public libraries and issued a fiat to say so.
I'm C.S. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Peter Linebaugh is his name. He's author of many books, including The Magna Carta Manifesto and The London Hanged. He wrote the introduction to Verso's edition of The Rights of Man and Common Sense by Thomas Paine. We are talking mostly about Thomas Paine today. And his new book is Stop Thief, The Commons, Enclosures, and Resistance, a volume that includes the essay from Verso's edition, as well as many other essays written by Peter over the years, many having to do with solidarity and commoning and the threats posed by capitalism and enclosure. And we have links to Peter and his work on our website, againstthegrain.org. So Thomas Paine wrote about, among other things, practices of commoning, and he seemed to really find meaning in harvests. Can you talk about that?
I certainly can, but I would prefer to read Thomas Paine's tremendous description of the harvest, when every individual, high or low, is interested in the fruits of the earth. Men, women, and children of all ages and degrees will turn out to assist the farmer, rather than that the harvest should not be got in. And they will not act thus by any other property. It is the only one for which the common prayer of mankind is put up, and the only one that can never fail from want of means. It is the interest, not of the policy, but of the existence of man, and when it ceases, he must cease to be. So we're likely to forget, you know, in our society, where fewer than 5% of people work the land, that Tom Paine grew up in an era when 90% of the people worked the land. And the single most important event was to bring the harvest in, because this is when the bread of the poor, the bread of all, was created to have a successful harvest. And surely he participated himself as a youth in the harvesting as he grew up. And if we pay attention closely to his prose, this is the only property, he calls it. That is, he calls labor a property, the harvesting for which the common prayer of mankind is put up. That would be the Lord's Prayer, which, as I'm sure you and your listeners know, calls for or petitions for our daily bread. Thomas Paine knew that this daily bread came from the harvesters, came from the reapers, came from the gleaners, that gleaning itself was a customary rite. Even though you may not own the land, the gleaner's queen led the women and the children of the village to collect that corn or that wheat which the harvesters had left over. This goes back to the books of Deuteronomy and the old Mosaic law. I mean, this is a fundamental to agrarian civilization, to agrarian cultures, that not to be too efficient, but to leave some left in the field. And of course, after the women and children had done the gleaning, you know, then the cattle were put in or the geese were put in. So many creatures and a very elaborate community of creatures, including human beings, participated. And it was a time of deep sacred and folk and musical and cultural meaning, the subject of the harvest.
Well, the sort of commoning activity that is the harvest and the commons and the common resources that are associated with the countryside suggests a really kind of a stark contrast with the city and with urbanization processes. And you write about this in other essays in this new volume, Stop Thief. Did Tom Paine, to your knowledge, was he disturbed by the process of people going to cities, entering wage labor, leaving behind many of the customary and commoning practices that were still being done in the countryside, but perhaps to a gradually decreasing extent?
C.S., my mind was a little bit off as you were asking that question, because it was, to tell you the truth, it was on William Blake, who also rewrote the Lord's Prayer, saying, "Give us the bread that is our due and right, by taking away money or price or tax upon what is common to all thy kingdom." So here, William Blake, who was exactly Tom Paine's contemporary and also a working artisan, you know, not a bourgeois literary figure at all, he is rewriting the central prayer of that culture, of Christianity, to see bread as a common right for all, not a commodity, hence taking away price or money. And there's no reason to think that this wasn't a common view. It was thought that none should profit while others starved. This is the basis of the moral economy. Now, to tie that point in to your other one is really a subject of importance, because it's well known that the poor in rural settings lived on a margin of existence that depended upon access to customary common rights. What is not known at all is that in the city, that same process of having access to the means or materials of production was criminalized. And so in the city, commoning seems to be criminality. This is quite a difference. Tom Paine did not, he was ashamed to see old age going to the workhouse and youth going to the gallows. In his last writing on agrarian justice, that's the phrase that he uses, characterizing the lifespan of a man, anyway, in England, from the gallows to the workhouse. But both the workhouse and the gallows were the instruments of criminalization for artisans whose margin of life was precarious and who, as the would take some cut in the product of their own labor, as the shipwright would take some chips or the tailor would take some cabbage. The cook, in short, had the right to lick his fingers. And we can go through every trade, every craft of the artisan. This is, of course, before the factory, before the machine. And we can see these customary perquisites or trade usages were essential. And an aspect of the introduction of machines, an aspect of the introduction of the factory, is the criminalization of those customs.
Peter Linebaugh, professor of history at the University of Toledo. His new book is Stop Thief, The Commons, Enclosures, and Resistance. It's published by PM Press. We'll take a short break and speak more with Peter Linebaugh. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Peter Linebaugh has taught at Harvard, NYU, Attica Penitentiary, and the Federal Penitentiary in Marion, Illinois. He's written a number of books, including The London Hanged, and with Marcus Rediker, The Many-Headed Hydra. He wrote the introduction to Verso's edition of Thomas Paine's The Rights of Man and Common Sense. And in that essay, this introduction to Tom Paine's volume, you focus in depth on two terms. One is revolution, which, you know, we all may have an idea of what it is. And the other term is constitution, which many of us think of as a written document that you can kind of hold in your hand and read. And in the case of the U.S. Constitution, it has the Bill of Rights and the Commerce Clause and all that stuff. Let's start with constitution. How did Tom Paine think of that term? How did he interpret it?
He thought of that term as people constituting government among themselves. That's how Tom Paine thought of constitution. He did not see it as a text, as a piece of paper. He did not see it as immutable, eternal, everlasting law. He saw it as an aspect of the activity of people constituting themselves as a people. So it was essential to the self-activity of democracy.
The Brits would point to their constitution, say that they had a constitutional monarchy. What was Paine's response to that?
They would say they had a parliamentary monarchy. He thought that priestcraft and kingcraft ruled the people in alliance with the owners of the land, and he opposed all three, church, king, and landlords. And this did not make him any friends in England, or, I should say, in the USA.
And what about the term revolution in Tom Paine's view, both in the practical sense, and we've talked a little bit about that when we talked about Flint, and in what you call the cosmic sense?
Yeah, the cosmic sense is the Earth makes a revolution around the sun. It's a revolving. So one strain of ideas concerning revolution is the notion of return. But I don't think that this was central to Thomas Paine's concept of revolution, though it included that. He was an astronomer and a scientist, like all of us ought to be, you know, to look and think upon the heavens and how the cosmos acts and how we are within it. But for him, revolution was connected with the abolition of wretchedness and wealth, of misery and great wealth. And to him, most important is if a poor person was to have a bit of meat on the table now and then, he needed to have access to creatures, you know, such as geese or such as rabbits or such as occasionally deer. But the game laws denied to poor people access to the game, which was reserved for the nobility, who could ride roughshod over the small patches of land that the poor might have. And you could be severely punished for, quote, stealing game. I say all this because Tom Paine reminded people that if Parliament consisted of people who worked the land, there would be no game laws, and that one of the purposes of the House of Lords, of Parliament, was really to deny access to this source of protein, of human meals.
He wrote very powerfully about the, I guess you might call it, the indolence of the aristocracy, right? Of the extent to which the owners of the land, the renters of the land, did not actually do the work of the people who tilled the land, who did the material labor on the farm.
Yeah, He was a bit nasty there. Yeah, he compared them to drones, a seraglio of males who neither collected the honey nor formed the hive, but exist for lazy enjoyment. A seraglio of males, that means he considered them prostitutes.
Hmm.
He considered them whores, the great landlords in the House of Lords. So his language was very strong, C.S. You can see why he was hated by the ruling class. But for others, such a smile to have such direct language.
We've been focusing a lot on Thomas Paine's ideas and his writings. And one thing you do in this book is to put him in context, because there were debates and discussions about and around commoning in the latter part of the 1700s. William Ogilvy was writing, Richard Price. Tell us what some of the other perspectives on this issue were.
Well, what is that disease, C.S., where people shake, old people shake?
Parkinson's?
Parkinson's, yes. Parkinson's disease. It's named after James Parkinson, who was a very observant physician, who at the time that Tom Paine wrote in the great crisis of the 1790s was also, Parkinson was also an egalitarian. He also saw that the illnesses of the poor was the result of the pompous greed of the ruling class. And so Thomas Paine was not alone. You know, I've mentioned William Blake. We can mention Parkinson. We can mention Ogilvy, you said. Mary Wollstonecraft, the great feminist. She wrote A Rights of Man herself before she wrote The Rights of Women. John Thelwall wrote The Rights of Nature. Thomas Spence wrote The Rights of Infants. Between 1789 and 1795, there was a tremendous outpouring of hope for equality. Remember, the transatlantic slogan of the time was liberté, égalité et fraternité. You know, these was the summation of the hopes and dreams of the French revolutionaries to make it happen on the earth now. Equality, egalitarianism, to cut through the hideous hierarchy of wealth and class and language in England. So this was a revolutionary period, and Thomas Paine's Rights of Man, Part 1 and Part 2, and then his Agrarian Justice of 1796 were part of a large discussion. And of course, that discussion arose, was in the context of a huge slave revolt and freedom struggle in the Caribbean, not to mention the struggle in France. This is before the terror has turned. This is before Bonaparte steps in as the emperor. And so Thomas Paine was not at all alone. And they wrote against enclosure. There were many, and not just poor people, not just commoners who were losing their rights, but others could see that this led to a debasement of human beings, that this led to a tremendous wretchedness and misery. And I think such people thought that, or believed that, if England was to have a proud soldiery, if it was to be able to defend itself, it needed to have people who could think, who were willing to do that. And the immiseration of the poor prevented such a thing from happening.
Peter Linebaugh is his name. He teaches history at the University of Toledo. And his books include the Magna Carta Manifesto and The London Hanged. And his new book is Stop Thief, The Commons, Enclosures, and Resistance. We are discussing today the essay in that volume about Thomas Paine. We have links to Peter and his work on againstthegrain.org. This is Against the Grain. My name is C.S. Song. How forceful was Thomas Paine on the issue of not the inclination of commoners to overturn the existing order, but their ability to do so.
Yes, well, I take a deep sigh over that one, because isn't it something we all still wrestle with? Thomas Paine wanted to arouse the people, and he was able to. He had great faith in the people, but he also knew that they required that direct language which I've mentioned. He discovered and he created a new language, a new discourse, a new relationship to power. The language was no longer the private software of ruling class thought, you know, where Latin and grammar and dictionaries were the licenses that permitted you to think. Thomas Paine turned those upside down and used language for a new purpose. He developed a new prose that, again, to arouse, to make people think. He really believed that people could think for themselves. And he helped us do that. And he still has that power.
Would you, though, agree, or would it be correct to say that Tom Paine, when he was writing in the U.S., that he was part of this perhaps overall emerging ethos of people writing for the common folk, getting away from some of the aristocratic traditions and modes of communication in the old country?
Yes. When he came to America, he thought he was getting away from that. He came as he was a Quaker, remember? So he was a friend, I should say. He went to Philadelphia. He wrote against the slave trade. He aroused the people for the American War of Independence, which he also thought was an American Revolution. But then the revolution is over. The country must govern itself. The compromise is set in. What is his relationship going to be to the slave South? What is his relationship going to be to the conquest of the Indian lands of the Ohio Valley? What is his relationship going to be to the immigration of people from Ireland? These were questions that are, in different forms, are still with us, and they account for the contradictory nature of Tom Paine's life, because he lived in a society that was full of contradiction.
Yeah, you call Tom Paine a planetary revolutionary, and yet you also write in this book, Stop Thief, that Paine, quote, would bend, if not kneel, to power. He would?
Yes, he was a practical revolutionist in the midst of war. He was a practical nation builder, you might say, to use today's lingo. You know, after the Treaty of Paris, 1783, the USA gets its independence. We have the Articles of Confederation. What is his role here? The bankers step in. Morris, the fattest banker of the time, and Tom Paine. What kind of money are they going to have? Are there going to be 13 different monetary systems? Is the commodity going to rule? These are the practical questions of the day. How much is bread going to cost? Who's going to produce it? What role is Tom Paine going to have with these emergency questions? And before he can answer them, he finds himself back in England, not in the USA. So this, I'm trying, and he wants for his own life. He's got to make a living. How is he going to live? Revolution doesn't pay your bills, doesn't supply feed for your horse. Well, he's an entrepreneur himself. He thinks, oh, I'll make an iron bridge. The first time such a thing has been done. And he tries to promote it in Philadelphia. He tries to promote it in France. He tries to promote it in England, you know, across the Schuylkill, the Seine, and the Thames. But he doesn't profit from it. He's not He's not good with money. And before you know it, the French Revolution has burst out.
And in France, this is a really good story here. He escaped the guillotine. How did he do that?
He was sentenced. He was imprisoned, along with Condorcet. He was imprisoned in Paris, this first citizen of the French Republic. Why? Because he opposed the death penalty. He did not believe that Louis XVI should be guillotined, and he voted against it. And his reasoning, let's go back to the English Revolution. Remember, they had executed Charles I, a great mistake, because it created a martyr. And with that martyr, it created for the first time a royalist party where none had existed before. So by executing Louis XVI, he made a great many enemies, and they jailed him. But here we are in jail, and he's in jail with hundreds of others. Many of them, as I said, like Condorcet, were brilliant people. Condorcet, in particular, believed in the benevolence of human nature. He had a great theory about the different stages of history. And in the evenings, they would sit and, swap stories. But also, and then it came for the evening to be over, the cell doors were slammed shut, and the executioner would come through and mark on the doors with an X those who in the morning were be taken off to the blade that would sever your head from your neck, the guillotine. But this one evening, the light had dimmed, the door was left open to Payne's cell, and whoever was doing the chalking chalked it. But then the door closed, so on the following morning, the chalk X was not apparent, and Tom Paine's life was preserved as the angel of death had passed him by.
Let's talk about today or more recent history. What can we learn from Tom Paine that we can apply today, given, as you write, that we live in a different world. We live in a world where everything is and has been enclosed. You write, our country, our world is closed, shut up. So what do we take from Paine?
Well, we must open it up again. What I take from Paine is the tremendous possibilities and surprises that await us once we get the vigor to move. What I take from Paine is his notion of constituting ourselves. How shall we do that? We tried to do it with Occupy. Hundreds of people centered in the cities of the USA to begin discussing and to start dealing with the divisions among us and to start small-scale commoning of how are we going to sleep, how are we going to provide security, especially to women and the vulnerable in the Occupy camps. How are we going to deal with drugs? How are we? We'd begun to discuss this among ourselves. And then, not the guillotine, but the police forces, with the knowledge of the White House, put an end to it. Why was it so important that it had to be shut up like this? Surely there is great promise in that experience. And surely we are still, of course, reeling from the defeat, but we also have begun to think. And this might be a moment for us to return to Thomas Paine. Not because we're going to imitate him or his recipes, but because of his faith, his hope, his willingness to spring to action. So that's just Thomas Paine. But there's commoning and commoners throughout our past history if we only have the eyes to see, and if we can make our historians and our scholars go do the work to find it. I'm especially proud of the African-American history in the United States, which has always, always had a commoning tradition, often with direct evidence to King Alfred of England or the Magna Carta, to habeas corpus, the prohibition of torture, and the necessity of jubilee, that is, the cancellation of debts. That is, the the reassignment of lands. That is, a year of rest. Yes, Jubilee, the greatest theme of songs of African Americans, slaves, before the Civil War, comes directly from this tradition of commoning. Though it's not the secular one that we have stressed with Thomas Paine, it's a religious one that could be found in baptism and Methodism. So I think we have tremendous resources to draw on now, but we must be willing to do it. We must be willing to get down to the work of it and to have faith that it can be done, that it's there for us.
What symbolic significance did you see with Occupy in the sense of taking over a part of the city being the site of so many enclosures, both figurative and literal, including, and I'm just reading some of the examples from your book, the hospital, the factory, the prison, workhouses, houses of correction, the school, old age homes. What do you see as the, did you see Occupy as sort of a kind of a takeover, a reclamation of the commons in the urban environment?
I would say even the agora, to use a Greek term, you know, thinking of the Greek struggle and of our time, but then to think of the past where the agora was part of the city where plebeians could come and talk, could come and begin self-constitution. So to me, that's the symbolic importance of Occupy.
Peter Linebaugh, history professor at the University of Toledo and author most recently of Stop Thief, The Commons, Enclosures, and Resistance, published by PM Press. Peter, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we will look for you next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.